Okay, somebody tell me, this is very important, you remember this. What was the movie we talked about last week? Who said that? Yeah, The Karate Kid, right? Because we need to remember this very important lesson. All right, wax on, wax off. That's right. Because that is the way the book of Hebrews is written. He says different things, and all of a sudden he just kind of drops something out of nowhere. And you're thinking, why in the world is that there? And he does that because he is teaching lessons throughout the book that are kind of the basis for other places. And though we may not understand why they are there. And that's why we're starting in chapter 6, verses 13 through 20, which really is kind of the foundation for what we're going to start talking about back in chapter 4 and verse 1. But he just kind of drops it in the middle of nowhere, and he says, this is why this is here. We're very linear people. What I mean by that is we like things in a very orderly fashion, don't we? We like this here, then the next step, then the next step. You think about how our sermons are preached. And Richard pretty much follows the same pattern every single time. He talks about something that Jesus or God said, and he uses Scripture to back it up, and then he will get at the end and he makes an application, right? And that's pretty much the way he preaches. That's the way almost everybody does anything when they're delivering public addresses. The Hebrew writer does that too, but also what he does, he throws a curveball every once in a while. How many of y'all played baseball when you was growing up? Not softball. Get your hand down if you were thinking softball. I'm not talking about softball. I'm talking baseball. The most feared pitcher in Little League was not the kid who could throw it straight down the middle. The most feared pitcher was a kid who knew how to throw the curveball. Because no little kid can hit a curveball. If you hit a curveball, that's why you're playing professional baseball now. The Hebrews writer likes to throw the curve. He likes to throw sliders. He likes to throw the knuckleball every once in a while. He does not throw it straight down the middle like Paul does in Romans. This is just different. And so then what you have in Hebrews is you have something going along that all of a sudden you just throw something. And that's what he does in chapter 6, starting in verse 13. There are three sermons for free that the Hebrew writer gives. In the middle of everything, he just says, oh, by the way, I got a sermon I want to preach to you. The first one is chapter 6, verses 13 through 20. The second one is found, again, not in order, chapter 5, starting verse 11 through going chapter 6 and verse 12. And the third one is chapter 13, which is in conclusion, which we know when a minister says in conclusion, that means nothing. That means I'm going to preach for about 30 minutes longer, and that's what he does in Hebrews chapter 13. He just has a third sermon. So there are three sermons he just kind of throws in here. We're going to talk about one of them this morning and then go back in chapter 4. Remember last week we talked about the first 2 weeks, is that the book of Hebrews can basically divide into three sections. Chapters 1 through 3 is the priesthood, preeminence of Jesus. Chapters 4 through, about halfway through chapter 10, is the permanency of Jesus. Now, I know if you look out on the internet, that document we put out there, it says the priesthood of Jesus. Just erase that. It's not the priesthood of Jesus. It's bigger than that. It's the permanency of Jesus. And then about the middle of chapter 10 through about verse 19, I think it starts, through the end of the book, it is the perseverance of Jesus. So if you're someone who likes to kind of have that stuff in mind, that'll teach you how to do that. The preeminence of Jesus, the permanency of Jesus, and the priesthood of Jesus. Okay? And the preeminence of Jesus, Jesus is greater than... No, first of all, the prophets, the angels, and Moses. Right. Three things very important to them. When we come down talking about the permanency of Jesus, then he breaks it down this way. If you want to write this down, then we're going to go to chapter 6. The permanency of Jesus is Sabbath rest. The permanency of Jesus is Sabbath rest. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. The permanency of Jesus' priesthood. Chapter 4, verse 14 through chapter 5 and verse 10. And then chapter 7, verses 1 through 28. So first of all, the permanency of Jesus' Sabbath rest. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. Secondly, the permanency of Jesus' priesthood, chapter 4, verse 14 through chapter 5 and verse 10, and then chapter 7, verses 1 through 28. He just skips an entire chapter, two chapters, talks about something else there for a while. The third one is the permanency of Jesus' covenant. The permanency of Jesus' covenant. Chapter 8 and verse 1 through chapter 9 and verse 10. The permanency of Jesus' covenant. Chapter 8 and verse 1 through chapter 9 and verse 10. And then the permanency of Jesus' sacrifice. Chapter 9 and verse 11 through chapter 10 and verse 18. Chapter 9 and verse 11 through chapter 10 and verse 18. So the permanency of Jesus' Sabbath rest, His priesthood, His covenant, and His sacrifice, which all those four items were very dear in heart to who? The Jews. The Sabbath, the priesthood, the covenant, and sacrifice and the temple worship, all very dear to the heart of Jews. And the Hebrew writer is saying here, I know those are all very dear to you, but let me give you those things that are permanent. Because the things in the Judaistic system, they were all vanishing away, right? The Sabbath was being done away with. The covenant was being done away with. The temple was being done away with. The sacrifices were being done away with. He said, those are all disappearing. You want to believe in Jesus because His are permanent. They're not going to go away. And we need to remember those things. Not in the same way they did, but the same concept. Now, in chapter 6, verses 13 through 20, he lays the foundation for all that. It is all built upon the promises of God. And let's talk about that just for a moment. Starting in verse 13 of Hebrews chapter 6. When God made His promises to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself. God said, well, I really can't take an oath to anybody else, so I'll just take an oath to myself. Saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. We talked about that briefly. Now, it goes back talking about the promises of the covenant of God, or the promises of God. Men swear by someone greater than themselves, and that oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Do you like to say, I promise I'm going to do this? Who likes to say, I promise I'm going to do that? Oh, what a bunch of cowards. we like to say that. You know, sometimes when I can't get myself to do anything else, I'll tell God, I say, I promise you I'm going to do it. And I do it almost every single time. Now, I don't do it very often because God says, don't do that too often, okay? Because you get in trouble if you do that too often. But I do it, and every time I think I've done it, I've pretty much completed it, okay? Because God wanted to make the unchanging natures His purpose very clear to the hearts of what was heirs of what was promised, He confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. Now, we'll talk about those in a little while. But first of all, it says, God made an oath because He wants you to know that I don't lie. God said, I will not lie to you. I don't say one thing and then do something else. And you know what? We've got to believe that. We have just got to believe that if God said, I'm going to do it, that He's actually going to do it. And you know what our problem is? We really don't believe that. Because we've lived with an experience of people not keeping their promises to us, haven't we? Our parents have told us they were going to give us certain things for Christmas and we never got them. Our teacher told us we weren't going to have that test and we ended up having it. Right? Our husbands or wives have said, oh, I promise I'll do that for you, and then they don't go clean out the garage like they said they were going to do. So we've lived with people making promises to us and not keeping them for whatever reason, and so we start thinking that way about God. But God says, I will keep my promise to you. If I said I'm going to do it, I will do it. And that's very important to remember throughout the entire book of Hebrews. It's a very important concept to remember. Okay? He says, God did this. So then, two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope offered to us may be greatly encouraged. You should be greatly encouraged by the fact that God will keep His word. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where Jesus, who went before us, has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, write this down. This is very cool. In this phrase, God uses the word promise three times. He uses the word swear three times. And by the way, when the Bible talks about not swearing, it's not talking about taking an oath in the court of law. That's not the swearing it's talking about there, by the way. An oath two times. So He says promise three times, Swear three times, oath two times what God does. What does that God tell? What's God trying to tell us there? I will keep my word. That's why he says it over and over and over. He talks about the unchanging nature of his purpose. He talks about that God takes oaths to us. Okay, so, well, now what has that got to do with anything? Let's skip on down here. I want to show you one thing, and then we'll go back to Hebrews chapter 4. Look down in verse 18. I'm sorry. Verse 18. I want you to write this down. This is really a cool word. It said, God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope offered to us may be greatly encouraged. Write down the word fled there. F-L-E-D. Okay? This is really a cool word in the Greek language. The Greek language, the word is kata phugontes. Now forget about the kata, the K-A-T-A. The Greek word is phugontes. Phugontes. What does that sound like to you as an English word? Huh? Who said fugitive? Okay, you get the prize. I'll give it to you later. Yeah, you won't get anything. I'm just kidding. Promises, promises. It's the English word that we get fugitive. He says we are fugitives. How many of y'all like the movie The Fugitive? Oh, that's one of my absolute favorite movies in all the world. Every time it comes on, I watch it again, wondering if he's going to escape. Yeah. That is one of my absolute favorite. He's a fugitive. And what he's saying here, he says that you and I are fugitives from Satan. When we were baptized, we became fugitives from Satan. And he says, we are fugitives escaping Satan. He's looking for us. He's Tommy Lee Jones. I don't mean it like that. But he's like the Tommy Lee Jones role. He's trying to track us down. He's trying to bring us back into captivity. He's trying to put us back into jail. He says, we are fugitives looking for the hope in front of us. And so we are fleeing from Satan. And the reason we can flee and keep fleeing is we keep believing the promises of God. See, we believe those things. That's why we just keep on fleeing. If you look in Acts chapter 14 and verse 6, write this down because we don't have time to talk about it. Acts chapter 14 verse 6, it says that when that they tried to kill Paul and Silas, I think it was, in Acts chapter 14, or maybe it's Paul and Barnabas at that point still. It says that they fled to Lyconium. It's the same word. That they ran away from the authorities to Lyconium because they didn't want to get thrown in jail at that point. And that's what we are. We are fugitives from Satan. And the way we maintain, we stay on the run. The way we stay on the run is because we believe that God is true to His Word. And that's what He's trying to get these guys to realize. Don't surrender back to the Hebrew covenant and all that stuff. Stay on the run. You've got to believe that God is true to His Word. You say, well, what's that got to do with anything? Because when you start back in chapter 4 and we start talking about the permanency of Christ, they've got to get it all in again that, wait a minute, I've got to really believe that the Sabbath rest is permanent. I've got to believe that the sacrifice is permanent. I've got to believe that the covenant with Jesus is permanent. I've got to believe that all these things from God are permanent, and so I don't need to go back to that stuff anymore. Look, and you say, what about me? Look, all this stuff that Satan offers you is not permanent. I was reading the other day, it was really interesting, is something Donald Trump had said. He had his little 10-year-old girl in their limousine and they were driving around downtown Manhattan. And it's just like, Donald, what are you thinking? He'd go by all these buildings and he'd say, honey, that is one day going to be yours. He would point all these buildings and say, that's yours, that's yours, that's yours. To his little 10-year-old girl, trying to impress her about what was going to be hers one day. And he said, you know what was weird? He said, she had her Game Boy and was playing it and wasn't paying a lick of attention to him. And that kind of made him think that was something was odd about that. See, people know deep in their hearts when we're children, and then we get all screwed up later on, things are not permanent. Your job is not permanent. Did you know that? Some of you are shocked by that. Your relationships may not be permanent. Now, you may live with someone forever, but eventually one of you will die. Now, mine and Christy's goal is to die at the same time, so neither one of us feels bad about the whole thing. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but nothing is permanent. Jesus is permanent. So keep fleeing. Keep holding on to the promise of God. And so when you go back to chapter 4, that kind of lays the foundation of the permanency of Jesus. In chapter 4, verses 1 through 13, let's read that. We're going to talk about the permanency of Jesus' rest. The permanency of Jesus' Sabbath rest. The big thing with them, if you'll remember, every time Jesus did something, he always did it on the Sabbath. Y'all notice that? Yeah. He's always irritating them. Yeah. I think he did it on purpose. Yeah. I think he liked to stir things up. You know, he's like, why ain't he anybody on Friday? It's not fun. Let's go to the synagogue to heal somebody tomorrow and see what happens, you know. And so that was very important to them. There are three things I thought of, two of them. To the Jews, the Sabbath, all the washing and cleansing of the bowls and all that stuff. And there's one other thing that were kind of the three main things that the Jews had really taken hold of. And just everything else was kind of like brushed aside, but those three things, I can't think of the third one. Well, so when you come to chapter 4 and he brings up about this whole idea of the Sabbath rest, he brings up something very dear to their hearts. And he says, Jesus' Sabbath rest is permanent. Therefore, since the promise of entering the rest still stands, and really start back in chapter 3 and verse, let's go back and do this right. Chapter 3 and verse 18. And to whom did God swear that they would never enter his rest, if not to those who disobeyed? So we see that they were not able to enter because of their unbelief. Therefore, since the promise of entering the rest, his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. We also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did, but the message they heard was of no value to them, because those who heard it did not combine it with faith. Now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God has said, so I declared an oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. And yet his work has been finished since the creation of the world. Now, we're not going to discuss chapter 3, verse 3, because I have no idea what any of that means. If you can figure that out, come tell me. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, and on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And again in the same passage above he says, they shall never enter my rest. It still remains that some will enter that rest. And those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in because of their disobedience. Therefore, God again said a certain day, calling it today, when a long time later he spoke through David, as was said before, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people, of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. Now keep reading, because this is part of it too. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and the attitudes of the heart. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before him, the eyes of him to whom we must give account. Sometimes we read verses 13 and 14 like they're kind of, but they're all part of that whole deal. So don't. And we'll talk about the role that plays in just a minute. There are basically five kinds of rest mentioned in these verses. Number one, rest associated with entering the promised land. He talks about the rest of entering the promised land. Number two, he talks about rest in heaven. Number three, he talks about God resting at the creation, which I think is really, really cool. Number four, he talks about the Sabbath rest. He references it. And number five, he talks about rest associated with people being close to God. So there are five kinds of rest mentioned here. Promised land rest, heavenly rest, creation rest, Sabbath rest, and closeness to God rest. Now you say, why does he bring that up? Because everybody likes to rest. How many of y'all take a nap on Sunday afternoon? Thank you. Thank you for being honest. greatest nap day of the week, isn't it? Oh, nothing like it. Nothing like it. You know, and sometimes I'll work real hard on Saturday and stay up later on Saturday night than possibly I should because I know I'm going to get my Sunday afternoon nap. See, we like the idea of that, don't we? We work real hard Monday through Friday because we know we're going to get Saturday, what? Off. And if someone comes in a big list of things to do on Saturday, we don't like that. Ladies, remember that. Did y'all hear about Joe Torre retiring from the Yankees, quit from the Yankees the other day? They're asking all these questions. I think it's funny, all the men sports writers asking, well, what do you, blah, 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 all these technical, all these questions. All the women sports writers asking very touchy-feely questions. So how did you feel? Nancy said, what was the first thing your wife said to you? He said, well, my wife told me she was very supportive. Whatever decision I came up with would be fine with her. And she told me, now you have time to clean out the garage. See, we don't like that. We like to rest. And because these people were getting frustrated and irritated and tired and worn out, he says, that's why he throws in chapter 4. I want you to know there's rest at the end of the day if you keep fleeing. There's rest for you. And he says there's these different types of rest. And he said there's only two things that can keep you from entering the rest. Do you see those? Look back in verse 19 of chapter 3. I'm sorry. Verse 18. And to whom did God swear they would never enter the rest, if not to those who disobeyed? Then look in verse 6 of chapter 4. It still remains that there's some will enter that rest, and those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in because of their disobedience. You know the only thing that can keep you out of heaven is the disobedience he talks about here? Well, there's two things that can keep you from resting in God in heaven. Disobedience and unbelief. First of all, let's talk about disobedience. He mentions disobedience twice. The word for disobedience is a really interesting word. It doesn't mean as we sometimes think it does. We sometimes think disobedience is, to God, is that, well, I'm trying, and I screw up, and God is real, real unhappy with me. The word here for disobedience means literally refusing to be persuaded. Now, I want you to write that down. You don't write down anything else today. I want you to write that down. Disobedience means, in this word that he uses, refusing to be persuaded. If your attitude is with God is this, I don't care what you say, what you tell me, what you promise me, I'm not changing my mind. Now let me tell you what's going to happen to you when you die. You are going to hell. If your attitude is, I refuse to obey you, I'm not going to do it, there's nothing you can say, nothing you can do, you're not going to change my mind, I don't care. If you keep that attitude to the day you die, you will go to hell. Now, I don't think that's most of our attitudes. My boys and I, we used to have this conversation. I'd ask them to do something, tell them I thought this was the right thing to do, and I'd say, do you agree with me? They'd go, no. No, I don't agree with you. I'm not going to do that. And somebody taught me to ask them this question. Are you open to the possibility of changing your mind at all? Not you, I'm not telling you change your mind. Are you open to the possibility of changing your mind? And you know, almost every single time after they thought about it, they go, yeah, I'm a tiny bit open to that possibility. You know, if you get that, you got something to work with, don't you? But there were times they would say, no, I'm not open to the possibility. I go, good luck. And they always suffered the consequences of that decision. See, I think everyone in here, just the fact that you're here today, for one thing, tells me that. I think everyone here is open to the possibility of changing your mind about things about God. You know what that means? It means that you do not have a disobedient spirit. And daggone it, as Andy Van Buren would say, you all be happy about that. That's good. Disobedience is not trying and trying and falling and trying. That's not disobedience. I think that's what we call faith. Disobedience is saying, I refuse. Not going to consider it. And he says here, that's what kept people out of the rest was disobedience. Remember, look at the example he uses. He uses the people going through the wilderness, and they got to the point where they said what? I ain't doing it God's way. That's why they all fell in the wilderness and never entered the rest. That's what happened. But if you don't have that disobedient spirit, you will enter the rest. He uses another word. Two things to keep you from entering the rest. Number two is unbelief. If you just decide not to believe anymore. Now, I'm not talking when I say unbelief. I'm not talking about struggling with trust and struggling with faith and sometimes I'm not believing and sometimes believing. I'm talking about that. I'm just talking about I ain't believing that anymore. Uh-uh. If you have that attitude, you're not going to enter the rest. There's only two things that can keep you from entering the rest. Number one is just having that daggone it, refusal heart. And number two, I don't believe that anymore. And see, they were not here, were they, in the book of Hebrews? That's not where they were. They were struggling with all this, and that's why he keeps bringing up the word hope. In fact, if you'll go back to chapter 6, look in verse... I knew you shouldn't brought this small print Bible. Look in verse 19. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. Hope. Believing, even though you can't see the end of it, and that's what hope is, hope, believing, makes you feel secure. It's an anchor for your soul, even when you don't feel secure. Now, just think just for a minute, and we'll close with this. What's the purpose of an anchor? That keeps the boat steady. Yeah, I don't know much about boats, but I pretty much got that one down. But do you see an anchor doing its best work when it's parked out here on Lake Allatoona and the water's down and the anchor's there holding the boat in place? No. When do you see an anchor doing its best work? The storm. Let me tell you when you see an anchor doing its best work. Pirates of the Caribbean. The first one. When they're out there fighting and they're wanting to turn the ship around, they don't know how to do it, and the girl pirate, okay, says, toss the anchor down. They say, what? Toss the anchor down, and it'll swing the boat around. And they throw the anchor down, and it just swings the boat around violently so they can go back and attack the people who are chasing them. That's when you see an anchor doing its best work. It's when there's a bad storm, or you're in the middle of a big fight, and you need it for fighting. It's not when the lake levels are down, and there's no storm on the water. It's okay then, but it doesn't do its best work then. And that's what he's saying. That our hope in God, our faith in God, does its best work when there's a storm a-brewing. We're in the middle of a battle. You say, well, that's what I feel like I am in right now. Good. You are not dead. If you're fighting, if you're struggling with your finances, with your spouse, with your children, with your grandchildren, with whoever, with whatever, with your job, good. With that sin that keeps coming back to attack you and to drag you back into the world, and you just keep fighting because you're a fugitive and you want to flee from it, good. You are alive. It's when you don't feel those things, it's when you're dead. Jesus' rest is permanent. And it's permanent because, and it is for people who are in the middle of a fight. And next week, or 2 weeks now, we're going to talk more about the fight. We'll talk about the permanency of Jesus' priesthood. And so what I need you to do, between now and then, I need you to read chapter 7. Well, really pretty much just all of chapter 7. And what I want you to do, I want you to go back in the Old Testament and I want you to find the two chapters in the Bible besides Hebrews that talk about Melchizedek. Good assignment, okay? There's two chapters in the Bible that talk about him. So we'll talk about the priesthood of Jesus that's permanent. I want you to read about Melchizedek, and we'll start talking about that in 2 weeks, starting in chapter 7. Thanks. Go get your children.